groups if they ask?
We didn't, did we? Oh, well.
For those of you who are wondering where you are, just in case you're not in the right room, you are in the right room. This is the session on Sex Lives of the Sisters, Research Results from a Survey of Married Mormon Women. My name is Janie Fleet, and the panelists this afternoon are Breida Stewart, Harold Christensen, and Mary Beth Raines. I'd like to remind you that for any of the sessions at Sunstone this weekend, you can get taped copies and just fill in an application that's available in your program or out at the registration table. Our first speaker is Breida Stewart. She is presently co-director of the Sex and Marital Therapy Clinic at the University of Utah Health Sciences Center. In fact, Ms. Stewart has been there for 14 years. She got her DSW at the University of Utah in 1985 and her master's in social work from Columbia in New York. Her doctoral dissertation dealt with the characteristics of women with inhibited sexual desires. As a result, several journals published articles relating to this topic and referencing her research. Ms. Stewart.
Hello. I'm going to be reading a paper that's the result of... Is my voice carrying okay? The result of research... that my colleagues Mary Beth Raines and Marge Pett, who's not here today, also participated in. And the three of us are co-authors of the paper, and we worked on the research together. I'm beginning to think... Excuse me. It's hard for me to stand still. And so this way I can carry my voice with me. Actually, as I'm watching Janie fan, and I'm feeling like fanning, I'm wondering if it's appropriate or inappropriate to begin to speak about sexual experiences first by starting to undress a little. Excuse me here. And also, if you'll pardon the pun, it's hot. Sometimes it's hard for me to announce that publicly. I have to look around to be sure that some other people, notably females under the age of 45 or males of any age, are not perspiring before I say that it's hot. Several years ago, while one of the authors was preparing a lesson for Release Society on sexuality, a friend was consulted about how to summarize the LDS Church's position on various sexual practices. She quickly replied, "Just tell them no." True, most direct messages from the institutional church about sexuality are of prohibition or at least of limitation. The single but important exception is marital sexuality. Mormon theology sees sexuality as sacred and as an attribute of God. Thus, Mormon sexuality has both positive and negative sanctions, and both types of sanctions are very powerful. How do Mormon women relate to their sexuality? Except for anecdotal evidence, we simply do not know. The bulk of research about Mormon sexuality has been about premarital sexual practices or about the prevalence of birth control. I'm still worried about the mic. Is my voice reverberating, or can you hear me in the back? Too close? Okay. Is this better? Here? Thanks. A lot of things are better that way, aren't they? And just about that size from a woman's point of view, but as I think, I'm sorry, excuse me, but Actually, I believe it was Roseanne Barr who was trying to understand the male mentality, and decided that the reason that men could read maps so well and women couldn't is that it would take a male's mind to believe that 1 inch could equal 60 miles. So, anyway. The bulk of research about Mormon sexuality has been about premarital sexual practices or about the prevalence of birth control. Messages from the pulpit have expounded the general purpose of sexual interaction, the dangers and sinfulness of extramarital and premarital sexual practices, general warnings against the practice of birth control, virtually absolute prohibitions against abortion, and the sinfulness of unnatural practices, mostly not specified. Statements about marital sex are usually very general, offer no advice about specific practices, but encourage gentle and tender expressions of love. Since awareness of sexual interaction is fairly limited in the church, Mormons are left to draw their own conclusions about sexuality from official church statements and their own private experiences. There is an abundance of information about sexuality emerging from literature, self-help books, the media, social science research, and clinical experience of psychotherapists. However, many LDS people are wary to accept information from these sources. Given these constricted circumstances, more information about the sexual experiences of people in the church would help to increase the fund of information about this crucial area in life. To this end, this study began while two of the authors were collaborating for a panel discussion on Mormon women's sexuality at the August 1988 Sunstone Symposium. Rather than discuss this issue from a purely clinical perspective, the authors decided to invite LDS women to lend a voice to the presentation by describing their own experiences regarding their own sexuality. Design of the study. Given the time constraints of the study and the difficulty of requiring a random sample of Mormon women, a convenient sample of women was used. A disadvantage of this technique is that the results obtained cannot be generalized beyond the participants. The majority of the questionnaires were distributed through women's groups, which had been informally organized to discuss various Mormon women's issues. Following the Sunstone presentation, the study was expanded to include non-LDS and clinic populations attending either individual or marital therapy. The questionnaire that was distributed to 210 women consisted of 49 very specific closed and open-ended questions, which asked the respondents about various aspects of their sexual lives. 158 women, or 75.2%, completed the survey. Of these 158 women, 103 were Mormon women. The remaining 34% of the sample identified themselves as Christian, 7.1%, Jewish, 14.7%, other, 1.9%, and no religious preference, 10.3%. The non-LDS composition of this sample was skewed because of the large response by Jewish women. Again, care must be taken not to generalize these results beyond the specific sample population. However, we believe the LDS women in this sample are likely to be representative of those Utah women who read Sunstone regularly or who, therefore, might be here today. Given that the original focus of our study was on sexual issues for Mormon women, this discussion will be directed primarily to the responses of the 103 LDS women who completed the questionnaire. Our typical respondent was 40 years old, married to a man 41 and a half years old in a first marriage of 15 years duration. The average family income was almost $57,000 per year. Since the average income was high, and 79% of the women were working only part-time or not at all outside of the home, it's apparent that the husbands of these women generally earned very large incomes. Additionally, the respondents were more educated than average Mormon or American women. More than 63% had graduated college or had an advanced degree, and they were overrepresented in professional and business ownership. Education and employment characteristics of the respondents. Since women's employment is a much discussed issue in the church, we felt our results were quite interesting. Approximately one-third of these Mormon women worked full-time, yet two-thirds worked at some paid employment outside of the home. LDS women seemed to be listening to two voices. One voice, the church, says, do not work when your children are at home. The other advice, which advocates women working for financial necessity or career and personal development, says, work when you want to or when you deem it necessary. While these women were not specifically asked about the number and age of children they were raising, they appeared to be able to integrate the two voices rather than choosing one over the other. Also, the vast majority of these respondents, 90.3%, reported attending church weekly. In every area of inquiry, religious activity and its influence on the respondents was rated very positively. The average frequency of church attendance among these women is much higher than the church-wide rate for Mormons and for Americans in general. More importantly, our respondents believe their religion was crucial in their lives. These results are noteworthy because these women, for the most part, came from groups which discuss not only women's issues, but Mormon women's issues. Many, if not most of these women, would likely identify themselves as feminist, or if they would not use that label, still would have feminist feelings and feminist opinions. They likely think about their religious life from many points of view and have been exposed to various other philosophies and other religions. Still, their commitment to Mormonism is remarkably high. Thus, the concern of church authorities about Sunstone-type forums questioning and a generally liberalized outlook seems ill-founded in regard to this group. Marital satisfaction. 90.3% of the women in this sample rated their commitment to their marriage as very high. Also, a majority of these women rated their overall trust in and love for their husbands as high, 88.3% and 74.8% respectively. Responses to the more intimate questions about emotional closeness and romantic love showed a substantial differences. Only 55.3% of the sample indicated a strong closeness, and 52.5% of the sample indicated a romantic love for their spouses. These differences may imply that longer-term marriages tend to lose their romance. Nevertheless, love and trust can be maintained even if romantic love and emotional closeness has diminished over time. Sexual history. The sexual history. Wow. Excuse me. maybe I'm getting to the hard part here. The sexual history of these women was also explored. The age at first intercourse ranged from 13 to 39 years, with the average age being 21.2 years. This is fairly typical for women with some college education who were 21 in the 1960s and 1970s. The current average age for intercourse for Americans, computed from reports of males and females of all education levels, is 16 to 17 years old. This sample's report of the number of women engaging in premarital intercourse appears, however, to be slightly higher, that is 31.7%, than the results obtained in Dr. Christensen's research. In three studies conducted in 1958, 1968, and 1978, which, by the way, in 1968 to 78, the women in our sample would have been the age of the women in his sample. 22% of Orthodox Mormon college youth in Dr. Christensen's sample engaged in premarital intercourse in 1958 and 27% in 1978, only a 5% increase in 20 years. By the way, I understand that, I believe it was yesterday, that Dr. Tim Heaton, am I getting his name properly, reported now that 60% of LDS women now experience premarital intercourse. Do I have that figure correctly? Pardon? 58%. Okay. Thank you. In comparison, and using information from the same three studies, Midwestern college students' premarital sexual intercourse rate increased 20%. And non-Mormon Intermountain College youth engaging in premarital sex increased 35% in the same 20-year span. Additionally, attitudinal studies of Mormon college students over four decades show increasing conservatism among Orthodox youth over time. In 1935, 88%, in 1969, 87%, and in 1973, 98% reported they were opposed to premarital sexual intercourse. Of course, as we all know, what our belief system is and what our actions are often conflict. Only 7.8% of the women in our study reported extramarital sexual experiences. This is extramarital, not premarital. National studies during the 1980s report that 29% of married women have one or more extramarital affairs at some time during their marriage. Similarly, the number of women who reported having same-sex relations was extremely low at 5.9%. Since sex with another woman was open to individual interpretation, the response to the question may have ranged from any sexual contact to orgasm. These figures, again, are lower than the national average. Among U.S. females, Kinsey found that half of college-educated women and approximately 20% of non-college-educated women had at least one same-sex erotic contact after puberty. Masturbation is a major issue for Mormon men and boys, but is rarely mentioned in connection with women. According to the information obtained, 53.5% of the respondents in our study masturbated as younger women, although for the most part only occasionally. The current incidence of masturbation among these women had diminished to 42.6%. Among American women, approximately 70% report masturbating. Sexual abuse. LDS women in our sample were not immune to sexual abuse. More than a quarter, 26% of them reported having been molested. One might intuitively think that given the positive religious influence during childhood, these women would be at lower risk for sexual abuse, more protected from harm than women from less religious homes. There is some evidence, however, that religious homes have as high an incidence of sexual abuse as non-religious households. Professionals estimate that 20 to 40% of women are molested or raped before age 18. Thus, in a group of females, including a gathering of Mormons, it is reasonable to expect that 1 out of 4 will have been sexually abused. These figures also suggest that LDS girls and women are at as great a risk for sexual abuse as other populations of women. Whereas 26% of the women reported being sexually molested, 6.2% of the women said that they had been raped. Thus, this group of LDS women experienced these abusive realities in as great a frequency as women from other religious or socioeconomic groups. Affectionate and sexual relationships. When asked about affection in their marriage, 57.3% reported showing very high physical affection toward their spouse. And similarly, 44.8% of the women reported their husbands reciprocating that affection. However, more than a third, 35.3% of the women, reported withholding affection, fearing it may lead to sexual intercourse. Nevertheless, given that the average marriage in this study is 15 years, the durability and reciprocity of affection is quite noteworthy. The majority of the women seem highly involved in their sexual relationship. 98% of the women indicated they engaged in sexual intercourse with their spouse. The estimates of the frequency of intercourse varied greatly, with reports ranging from 0 to 6.2 times per week, which averages to 1.6 times per week. The percentage of times the women initiated sex also ranged widely, with reports from zilch to 100%. The average being 34%. 70.3% of the women rarely refused their husband's invitation for sex. 82.5% expressed a medium to high desire for their spouse. 62 and 70.6% respectively were very aroused or highly aroused during love play or sexual intercourse. Even though these participants reported high levels of sexual arousal, only 54.9% expressed a high level of emotional satisfaction. For women, physical satisfaction with a sexual relationship does not necessarily equate with emotional satisfaction. Lovemaking behaviors. These women are not only highly interested in sexual interaction, but are also quite involved in a fairly wide range of lovemaking behaviors. The least frequent practice was genital kissing or oral sex of wife and husband. Yet these practices were still engaged in by more than 60% of the sample. 84 to 94% of the sample population engaged in mutual body caressing, including genital caressing and breast caressing. These same percentages also held true for lip and breast kissing and French kissing. A less frequent practice was genital play to orgasm. 57.1% of husbands caressed their wives to orgasm, and 41.2% of wives stimulated their husbands to orgasm. In nearly all societies in which there is record, it is almost always the male who provides the more active stimulation. These women also reported a wide range of time spent in love play, from 0 to 52 minutes, with the average time being 15.7 minutes. And intercourse... Listen, this is an important figure because... Mary Beth, do you have Kinsey's figures? I think it's less time. And this is even more important because I have the proper time for the next. It says intercourse would go on sometimes from 1 minute to almost an hour, with the mean being 14.6 minutes. But when Kinsey's report on the sexuality of the male was published in 1949, there was a paragraph in there in which he was explaining how quickly the male ejaculated. It was about 2-point-something minutes. And he was rationalizing by saying that this was an evolutionary process, and at one time the male had to quickly deposit his seed and go chase the saber-toothed tiger around the tree. Now, to show that really sexual expression is very much influenced by the times. Let's see, that report was 1949. In 1966, and that's less than 20 years later, Masters and Johnson published their first volume on human sexual inadequacy and labeled that 2-point-something minutes premature ejaculation and indicated that it is epidemic in the American male, and they thought of it as a quote-unquote dysfunction or disease. So that is just a way of indicating how much, I don't want to say how much, but that the times that we live in very definitely influence our sexual expression, as well as the culture in which we live in influencing our sexual expression. Although the majority of women in the study reported engaging in a variety of sexual practices, there still remained 10.2% of the women who did not experience body caressing, 9% did not kiss lips, and 15.5% did not French kiss. Given that 18.6% of the women reported low emotional satisfaction with their sexual relationship, it's possible that some of the women are not receiving sufficient physical contact or love talk, including talk about feelings, or time and love play to enhance their emotional satisfaction. An additional expression of sexual interest includes internal sexual thoughts and feelings. When asked if they had sexual fantasies, 74.5% replied affirmatively. Very limited information is available regarding the frequency, content, and timing of women's sexual fantasies. Unfortunately, this material was not explored in our study. Orgasm and subsequent love play. The respondents indicated that they had experienced orgasm during lovemaking an average of 66.1% of the time. Experiencing orgasm occurred in several ways, four of which are considered usual and customary. These are orgasm through sexual intercourse, through oral stimulation, manual stimulation, and self-stimulation. The fifth, the use of a vibrator, occurred 15.2% of the time. Use of the vibrator is a more recent practice, and the degree and circumstance of its use is not widely known. Women often express an interest in continued loving connections following intercourse. In response to a given list of behaviors in the questionnaire, the three predominant activities were remaining physically connected, that is still connected with penis inside the vagina. The other was holding one another, and the third is saying, I love you. For many women, these behaviors were a very important ingredient in the emotional satisfaction of their sexual experience. Spirituality and sexuality. The responses of the women regarding the relationship between their sexuality and spirituality fell into two categories, as either congruent with one another or as separate and/or conflicted. Respondents also offered strongly stated observations about how the church had influenced their sexual thoughts, feelings, and behavior. Although some women indicated that there was conflict between their religious lives and their sexual experience, the majority of the respondents stated no conflict existed. 61.4% reflected congruence between their sexual experiences and their religious lives. One woman expressed this congruence in the following way. Sexual relations are closer and more satisfying when experiencing greater spirituality and in tune with God. After sexual relations, I feel very calm and more at one with my husband and God. My gratitude increases and love of self heightens. Sexual climax for me is a built-in reward or gift from God when my total physical, emotional, and spiritual spheres unite into one. Variations on these themes noted that, quote, good sex, unquote, with their spouses help to increase the woman's love for their families. Others expressed, for example, faith in and love for someone is a spiritual experience. Other women reported that a positive connection between sexuality and spirituality occurred when their ideal of love was being fulfilled. One woman wrote, "I view spirituality in a holistic way. Sex is just part of our physical nature. Love is much more. It encompasses our whole being and our relationship with the universe." Perhaps women who define spirituality more broadly can make a greater positive connection between their spirituality and their sexuality. Another woman summarized, "If there is a God, sexuality is the greatest gift." Even for those women who were experiencing frustration in their sexual relationships, their spirituality helped some of them cope with this difficulty. For example, one woman wrote, "We maintain spirituality in spite of our sexual frustrations. Spirituality gives us hope that somehow, with us both working on it, we'll have a better sex life. It keeps us from giving it up, and chucking it all." For women who indicated a conflict between sexuality and spirituality, the source of the problem was often linked to the marital relationship. Repeated themes were loss of trust. In several cases, infidelity had occurred. Lack of courtesy in the overall relationship, difference in expectations concerning sexual frequency, exhaustion with work and children, or too much focus on the physical actions and not enough on the emotional aspects of the relationship. One woman wrote that her husband's attitude was, "Sex is, give me my goody and let's be done, and I don't want to talk about it." Another woman wrote of her dilemma, "I have a longing for sexuality to be a celebration of a spiritual and emotional personal relationship. I'm wondering if there are men who can do that. I feel I can't be very spiritual and have good sex too." Guilt, anxiety, shame, disgust, a negative view of sex were also listed as causes of difficulty. When one woman's husband encouraged her to view pornography, she felt less loved and more like an object. Another woman expressed her sexuality-spirituality conflict as a conflict between emotional love and physical need. If you're wondering how come our infrequent sex with such low levels of love and emotion can be quite good, I think it's because I've been able to partially separate emotional love and physical sex in my mind, so that I can enjoy the purely physical aspect of sex, even though I don't have the love I wished I had with it. If I allow thoughts of resentment and withholding due to anger to come into play, it ruins sex for both of us, which does happen once in a while. To summarize these women's experiences, it appears that spirituality plays a more positive than negative role in enhancing their feelings regarding their sexuality. This is consistent with other studies that document that religion seems to have a positive effect on marital sexuality. Conclusion. Despite the limitations of the research design, the results which have presented here offer a beginning understanding of the scope and complexity of the sexual issues that Mormon women, indeed all women, face. Perhaps the greatest value of the project is that it provided the respondents a forum to speak in regard to a topic about which there is usually silence. For women to find their own voice, particularly in the area of human sexuality, is very important. It is only through the information provided by women themselves that the range of women's sexual experiences and the accompanying meaning of those experiences can be both discovered and acknowledged. Mormon women in the past have not talked openly about the interior of their sexual lives. Neither feelings, thoughts, nor actions with regard to sexual experiences have been discussed enough for any woman to reference herself to others and know what other women in similar circumstances experience. Perhaps this study is a beginning attempt will perhaps excuse me this beginning attempt will stimulate further discussion and inquiry, and we hope to have discussion from you and the panel. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. I was remiss earlier when I was introducing Dr. Stewart to give you some background first on Mary Beth Raines, because she will not be formally presenting a paper and will participate instead in the question and answer period, and that will follow Dr. Christensen's response. Dr. Raines is a licensed clinical social worker and marriage and family therapist in private practice. She has had articles published in Sunstone and Dialogue and various other publications, in addition to presentations on such topics as Mormon mental health and women's issues. Dr. Raines has taught marriage and family relationship courses at the University of Utah for 10 years in conjunction with sociological research. Although having recently resigned her position as adjunct assistant professor of the Graduate School of Social Work, she will continue in that appointment for a few more months. Dr. Raines mentioned that she is experiencing a delightful change in her life. Her last child has now left home, and she has a clean house for the first time in 20 years. Currently, Dr. Raines is preparing for publication of a book she is co-authoring with Wayne and Ron Scow. It's entitled Peculiar People, Mormons, and Same-Sex Orientation. Published by Signature Books, it is expected to be available by October of this year. Now I'd like to give you some background on Dr. Christensen. Dr. Christensen provided me with a long list of information describing his distinguished career. I wish I could recount it all to you. Briefly, however, he has received a degree from Ricks College, his BS and MS from BYU, and his doctorate from the University of Wisconsin. He has held positions in the sociology departments of BYU and Purdue, went to Denmark as a Fulbright Research Fellow in 1957, has had visiting professorships at 8 different universities, and has held offices in several professional organizations, such as President of the National Council on Family Relations, President of the Ohio Valley Sociological Society, a member of the National Fulbright Screening Committee for Sociology Applicants, and was a consultant examiner for accreditation with the North Central Association of Colleges and Secondary Schools. A rather prolific writer, Dr. Christensen has authored 6 books, published some 70 or 80 articles in professional journals, contributed over a dozen chapters in other writers' books, produced 4 pamphlets, and written about 30 reviews. He proudly proclaims the continuation of the Christensen name through 5 children and 18 grandchildren. Now, may I introduce Dr. Harold Christensen.
Well, you know, that sounds like I ought to know something, doesn't it? But I don't really. All you'll get today is views, opinions, reactions. I shall not attempt to deal with percentages, the barrage of percentages that have been presented, all appropriate. I'll not get into that area. I'll attempt to deal with more of the broader issues pertaining to research. Well, first, the good news. I am somewhat acquainted with the earlier published work of the senior author, Mary Beth Raines, and am highly respectful of both its insightfulness and its courage in calling a spade a spade. In speaking out forthrightly, though tactfully, on controversial subjects in the face of certain existing institutional pressures. Now, this present paper represents another contribution written in the same vein as the earlier ones, and it plows new ground. I might say in passing, too, I'm very pleased to get acquainted with Frieda Stewart today for the first time, and with Janny Fleet, who is chairing this session. Treating highly personal and sensitive sexual phenomena dealing with such intimacies as feelings, behaviors, responses of persons concerning such as the non-marital sexual histories, exposures to sexual abuses, and lovemaking techniques and arousal factors within marriage. If handled in a professional manner, using correct terminology and protecting the anonymity of subjects, as was done here, should elicit praise from us, not concern. Surely this open, responsible treatment will not be seen as titillation, except perhaps by a few of the immature and emotionally sick. How else, one might ask, than this reaching for honest information, honestly expressed, can the researcher, the educator, and the clinician, to say nothing of adult men and women everywhere who must lean upon these professionals for guidance, have any real basis for understanding themselves or understanding human nature generally, or have the knowledge necessary for preventing and or remedying the blunted satisfactions and messed up conditions that seem to engulf so many in modern times. Now, I do, however, although my overall response to this paper is favorable, as you will have gathered, I do have a few critical comments to offer. Near the beginning of their paper, the authors state, quote, "How do Mormon women relate to their sexuality? Except for anecdotal evidence, we simply do not know." And then a couple of paragraphs later, they explain that their hope is to go beyond the anecdotal, beyond the, quote, purely clinical perspective, end quote, using their own words, and by inviting LDS women to speak for themselves. I'd like to raise just a few questions concerning both of these statements. Regarding the first, I believe that although we still may be in the early stages of quantitatively researching this problem, we nevertheless do know something via this route about how Mormon women, even married Mormon women, which is the major concern of the authors of the paper, may be what they relate to their sexuality. We know something about how these relate to their sexuality. To substantiate this, permit me to mention a couple of generalizations from my own earlier reported cross-cultural research. There could be, and I believe there are, relevant research items reported by other scholars, but I know my own work best. In the first place, unmarried college students who are Mormon show considerably less approval of and participation in premarital coitus than do others, from my research. However, of those who actually engage in coitus before marriage, it is the Mormons who experience the most guilt. The greater negative effects they experience come from violating their own higher standards. I have labeled this phenomenon value behavior discrepancy, and I have developed a theory which I call the principle of value relevance, In other words, the values people hold are the standards that are extant in their culture and seep into their personalities and shape their help shape their behavior, are an important factor in the formula. I remember hearing a church authority some years back when I was a youngster up in Rexburg, Idaho, making the point that they were to live pure and clean lives. And he said, in effect, other people in the world can do this and that and the other and so forth, and he named them. But he said, you can't, because you know better. Now, all he was talking about was the different standard, the different mores, the different norms, the different values that enter in to people in Mormon culture. Not all, to be sure. Now, among married, when premarital pregnancy data, still drawing from some of my own research, were linked with data on subsequent divorce, it was found that conception before the wedding significantly increases one's chances of eventually getting divorced. I might say that my cross-cultural research was approached in two ways. First, through the questionnaire administered to mainly university students in three cultures. Sexually permissive Denmark, a part of sexually permissive Scandinavia. A Midwestern sample in the United States, kind of in between, but roughly typical of the country as a whole, perhaps. And then a more conservative, restrictive Mormon culture in the Intermountain West that I speak of as the Intermountain sample. So the questionnaire, first of all, but then second, what I helped develop a method called the method of record linkage, where we took the actual marriage records and birth records and matched them case by case. And in that manner, we could calculate the interval between marriage and birth of the first child. And that interval was studied rather carefully to learn what we could about premarital conception and early marital conception. Still in these same three samples. Now, in all the three samples, those who became premaritally pregnant showed up later with higher eventual divorce rates in all three samples. But in Denmark, the difference between the two, those who had premarital conception and those who didn't, was very, very small. Didn't make much difference. Still a little bit higher for those who had premarital conception, but not much higher. In the Midwestern sample, it was much greater, something like this. In the Intermountain Mormon sample, it was like this, considerably greater. Why? Because these individuals in the Mormon sample, when they became premarital pregnant, were more likely to evaluate their own standards culturally instilled, you see. So once again, when the personal and cultural standards of a people are higher than average, as with Mormon culture, more of the respondents who overstep the bounds are found to be in violation of their own higher standards and as a consequence pay a higher price. I not only found, I should say from the questionnaire data, now you see subsequent divorce can be considered as a negative effect of premarital intercourse and premarital conception. As I say, the Mormons paid the higher price. The Mormons had the lower rates of premarital conception, but of those who premaritally conceived, the price they paid was higher in terms of a subsequent divorce. From the questionnaire data, I tried to measure their feelings the day after first premarital coitus. A number of items were mentioned. Take just guilt. Again, in the Danish sample, again, in all three samples, those who had premarital coitus had more guilt. But in Denmark, it was this way. In Midwest, it was this way. In the Utah Mormon sample, it was this way. Again, the price paid was higher. Not only this, but after, in Mormon culture, not only is premarital conception lower than the other cultures, but early postmarital conception is higher in the Mormon sample. So what are they doing? Their standards, the emphasis upon chastity is holding them back prior to marriage, not all, but some. But then after marriage, bang. 9 months and 9 months and 15 minutes, some said. At any rate, my research showed statistically, the higher rate of early premarital conception compared with the other two samples. Now, surely, I mention these things simply because this is some evidence, at least, that we know something about Mormon women. Yeah. And about married Mormon women, as well as unmarried Mormon women, you see. And it's, I think it's only an example. So I think your statement would have been better if you said we know nothing, if you'd said we know little, or we need to know more, or something like that. Now, regarding the second statement referred to above, it is not that I object to looking for answers by obtaining and then quantifying and analyzing the responses of human subjects. Indeed, this is the kind of research that I personally have fallen for, and I would have more of it. Clinical and statistical research need to be seen as complementary, each having a place and contributing to the other. My major criticism here is that I do not think this present attempt at quantification, at quantitative research, as valuable as it is, and it is valuable, has gone far enough in realizing its full potential. The paper as it stands follows the format of a research report. I mean, it states the problem to be investigated, describes the nature of the sample and the procedures to be used, reports and interprets the data that are produced, cautions about limitations, and ends by offering suggestions for further research, the usual inclusions. Still, I find something lacking. Most noticeably, I see this lack as a failure to reach an appropriate level of comparative generalization from the data. Hence, most of what is presented must be viewed mainly, I think, as description. Description stated in statistical terms, to be sure, percentages, but description. We know quite a bit about the particular highly refined convenience sample that they dealt with. We know very little about other Mormons, male, other females that don't fit that description, and we know very little about non-Mormons. I say it lacks any testing of relationships among variables to give points of association and our possible cause and effect connections. Now, in reading the aims of the paper, and I might say the paper that I worked with in preparing these notes was about twice as long as the paper that was just read, and I can understand this difference, of course. And the reducing and some revising with it has been an excellent job. The original paper contained 11 tables, and I'll refer to those just briefly, to some of those just briefly later. The paper given today summarized the data from the tables in textual form. But the reduced paper, which you have heard, did not give the four listed aims or functions of the research. I'll not read all four, but the last two led me to expect a testing of relationships among factors. Number three is, to what extent are sexual practices linked, note the word linked, to marital satisfaction, are associated, note that word, with past sexual history. And aim number four states, what are the observations of LDS women regarding the connections, note that word, between their sexual and spiritual experiences. I expected to see some of this. I found it absent or largely absent. Let's see, where am I? For example, in reading over the last two of the four research aims, well, I've given that already, I find that in the report, some of the statistical correlations between specific sexual practices on the one hand and marital satisfaction and spirituality or religiosity on the other. But nothing like this shows up. Oh, there were quotes from respondents concerning perceptions of connections between sexual practices and spirituality. But these, while interesting in their own right, and they are good, as case study material, are few in number, sketchy, contradictory, and generally unsuited for quantified generalization. Let me illustrate what I mean. If the sexual satisfaction measures of table 8 had been statistically tested for association with the marital commitment measure of table 4, we could judge whether or not the two are related. That is commitment, is sexual satisfaction greater when there is high marital commitment, and vice versa? I didn't see this tested. And if the testing were to relate sexual satisfactions with the religious influence scale of table 3, which is an approximation, perhaps, of degree of one's spirituality, we could judge whether or not the satisfactions in sexual matters either affect or is affected by spiritual qualities of a couple. We would have a statistically tested relationship between two variables, rather than just the respondents expressing themselves as to whether or not they felt that spirituality was related to their sexual practices. Similarly, if any or all of the specific sexual behaviors reported in tables 9 and 10 were to be statistically correlated or even just cross-tabulated with the measures of sexual and marital satisfaction already mentioned, we would come out with a significantly enlarged understanding of how these sexual practices, some institutionally approved and others not, masturbation, lesbianism, and so on, how these actual practices, some institutionally approved and some not, may be affecting both the marital and the sexual adjustments of the subject studied. Now, to further underline the predominantly clinical favor of this flavor of this report, and I don't object to this, but the report purports to be a research report, and I must examine it in that light. I would like to call your attention to two additional statements made by the authors. One near the beginning, after appropriately warning the readers against generalizing results beyond the population studied. They say, quote, however, the LDS women in this sample are likely representative of those Utah women who read Sunstone regularly and who therefore might be here today. Well, one might ask, what about others who will read it? Persons with characteristics unlike those in the sample, men as well as women, non-Mormon as well as Mormon, less educated and lower class persons with little sophistication in women's issues, as well as the highly selected, well-educated, comfortably incomed, and feminist-oriented subjects studied here. Perhaps most importantly, what about scholars of human sexuality everywhere who will run across references to the study? For, if published, the report surely will get into the mainstream of professional literature. In reporting their research, should not the authors be interested in speaking to all of these, just as interested as they have demonstrated they are in getting back to the specific persons or even kinds of persons that were studied. And two, near the end of the second, near the end of the paper, the authors say, quote, "Perhaps the greatest value of the project is that it provides the respondents a forum to speak about a topic about which there is usual silence." Now, while I agree completely with the claimed value of the project to the respondents themselves, I must point out that this concern is of primary interest to the clinician, not the researcher. Benefits to the subjects of a study, those who were studied, cannot be of greatest value in a research project. With true research, the central payoff lies in newly discovered data, and most especially in fresh understandings for all to know who would wish it, understandings derived from the testing of associations and relationships revealed by the data. Well, enough of this, for I do not want to be accused of nitpicking or carping. While I could have wished for a few procedural changes and further developments of the data, the study as it stands is full of insights and new leads. The authors have shown both modesty and courage. They've been careful to point out limitations and that their work is exploratory only, and they have demonstrated a lack of fear in facing important, although sensitive and controversial, issues that cry for solution. I am glad that they undertook this project, and I wish them well as they further pursue it and related studies over the years ahead, combining clinical insights with quantitative approaches to the benefit of both. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Christensen. We will now open it up to questions from the audience. Does anybody have any questions? Nothing? No one has anything that they want to? Oh, okay.
Do you have any intuitive feelings about the non-respondents? Do you think they would be the less well-oriented, the more uptight sort of work result here?
Go ahead.
I realize that's an intuitive question.
We haven't speculated much about that one. We had such a high response, 75%. Response on questionnaires mailed or handed out is a very high response typically. So we assume that most people who took it were, you know, willing to answer it. That's a possibility, of course, particularly since part of our sample was a clinical sample, although we didn't report directly on that. Some of them could be in that group also.
One other thing, though, we did attempt to reach a lot of groups that, you know, kind of turned us away. So it wasn't that questionnaires were sent out to them and trying to make a connection to get to certain groups of women. We were just told no. So that would also influence it, and so it's really hard to know. But that no was determined by one woman, not by the group.
Okay. This is one of the problems of the questionnaire approach in research, and I've had to deal with it as well as others, and I've used the questionnaire approach. A 75% return, which they have had, is a high return, and it should be reasonably reassuring to us, I think.
Okay, yes, over here.
They were not mailed out. They were given within a group. They were then taken home. They were not mailed out at the time, and we provided a procedure where they could be anonymously mailed back in. We know the identities of none of these women. If the women who filled out the questionnaire wanted to know the results, then they could send out a separate self-addressed envelope going to another address. So there is no way that we know the identity of these women.
Well, I was just wondering if you have any idea how much input the husband's had. I mean, like the 15 minutes.
No, we don't know that.
But again, that's one of the problems with any self-report measure in research. There are inherent problems with that, where there are just certain kinds of things you do not know and cannot control. So there could have been tampering.
Yes.
Yes.
I have a question. I just want you to clarify. You said
If I'm remembering that correctly, quite a large majority of the women experienced orgasm, and the average, 66% was the average amount of, out of 100, if you take the numbers of times that they were sexually engaged with their spouses, 66% of the time they would be likely to experience orgasm, is the way I interpret that. But I'll look that up again just to be sure.
No, we didn't ask that question.
Okay. Oh, Mike.
Let me clarify a couple of things. One of them is that the Kinsey data that we used are not just from the original research that he performed in the 1940s and so on. The Kinsey Institute continues to compile sexual research data from a number of sources. And in a couple of the comparisons we made, it was from the more recent data, so it was not all from original comparisons. As to your concern about a secular environment, I think that makes sense, and I really appreciate your reference to that book, and we'll look it up. Since approximately between 60 and 70% of Americans say they are religiously involved, religiously inclined, and believe in a God, I would say that probably some of that research would be obviously reports of these women also, so it wouldn't be, I think, an entirely secularly based group.
Yes, back there.
The first is that I showed this program to a friend of mine, a female friend of mine, and she
have a friend who's a marriage counselor back east, a Mormon marriage counselor, I would add. And in our discussions on one occasion, she mentioned that that sexuality in Mormon marriages is a hot topic, so to speak. Would you comment on that? Is there any truth to that? Would you say that's a fact here in the Valley?
I'll respond to the first half because I have very strong feelings. I think part of, how should I say? I think that sex and sexual behavior, which is just one dimension of sexuality, which has many dimensions, but sexual behavior, which we were paying quite a bit of attention to today, needs to have a public forum as a place to be expressed. That's a personal opinion. Just like I think your friend's response was probably a personal opinion, and we just differ. But from my point of view, women have been prisoners of silence for a long time. And not only sexual behavior, but for example, what we understand and know now about sexual abuse is because some people dared to speak out. And I think that if we cannot talk, or where we cannot talk, are places not necessarily that tend to be private, but that tend to bear with it some guilt, shame, anxiety, and a whole lot of what I would call negatively cathected emotions that go with things that we have to keep secret. So for me, it's really important to be able to have a public forum, and hopefully the presence of the people here is some indication that they are too interested in a public forum. Ladies, no, go ahead.
Well, we're dealing with a very controversial issue here, of course. Sex education at whatever level in the public schools with youngsters and on up has come under criticism as our society has moved along. Some claiming that sex education in the schools actually incites youngsters to sexual experimentation. It increases the kinds of things we don't want them to do, you see. Others claim that's just wrong, and I would be with this second category. And I think my position has been was made clear in my comments. I would endorse an open, frank approach to all items of sexuality in an adult manner, preserving the anonymity of subjects, not trying to get tittering, not trying to get sexual stimulation. I realize there'll be some of that as we change, as we get rid of our hang-ups, as we grow. But how else are we going to solve our problems, you see, unless we face up to them? And how can you face up to them unless you research them? And to research them, you've got to have terminology that applies to what you're talking about. Too long we've held these things in the closet, and they tend to ferment and clog one's emotions and personalities and result in worries and problems and frustrations that needn't be if we were more open about it. Now, I'm not advocating pornography. I'm not advocating an open titillation. It isn't that approach. It's a solid, objective, scientific, adult approach for information. More people, whether they're youngsters or adults, get into trouble out of ignorance. Ignorance concerning themselves as well as those they associate with. More get out of trouble because of ignorance than they do when they have information to base their decisions on.
I'd just like to briefly mention the second half of the question, which was, is it a hot topic here in the Valley? I don't have any objective data about that, of course, but I do have a couple of impressions, and my impression is yes, in that most women's groups that I have talked to or with or about have certainly talked about sex at some point. And just as an anecdote, a couple of women's groups told me that after our panel discussion on Mormon women's sexuality in 1988, that they bought the tape and spent all night talking about it.
We still have some time. Oh, way back over there.
Well, in an exhausted state a couple of months ago, we all vowed no. We do have a lot of correlative data that Dr. Christensen implied that we should include, which we didn't include simply because the paper was at that point 33 pages long. But we do have some correlations that we've considered maybe writing up and adding as a second installment.
Part of our problem is getting subjects in a way that we can do more than do more that would be identified as quote-unquote scientific. In the true, and again, quotes on that, sciences like physics and chemistry, anything you do in the social sciences is not considered scientific. When it happens at the level that we do, we really attempted, going back to that symposium, to want to present information besides just our clinical impressions, that somehow that didn't seem to be the way to go. And in an effort to collect data, it's very, very difficult to do the kind of sampling that is considered more pure without having access to what I call captive groups. And that's why a lot of studies, psychological studies, are done on students, not just Dr. Christensen's, but many psychological studies are done on students because they are a captive group. Okay, Jean.
Were there any surprises for you? And what did this teach you? Or what might you do with this? Say you were General Relief Society President. You had this data before you were to speak in general conference. Did you say anything different?
I don't know that there were any surprises as much as some impressions were confirmed. Given the strong statements by church leaders about no masturbation, no oral sex, no premarital intercourse, given the loud capital N no's, these women had made up their minds, obviously, in another direction with a differing frequency. Secondly, given the amount of negative language about sexuality coupled with the minor theme of it's wonderful in marriage, these women seem to have picked up the minor theme and said, yes, it is enjoyable, yes. And so in some ways it may just be not the church voices at all as much as that sexual behavior, sexual lovemaking is so self-reinforcing that you can say yes to it after a while. Would I say anything different in the church like conferences? Well, yes, of course, I would say about this study, you mean, or about these?
Yeah, what did you learn at the speech? You say something that might be helpful to Mormon women and men.
I would say, well, I find the results actually encouraging in that there's a direct linkage between, or not linkage, I guess we can't say that, Dr. Christensen, that... you know, between high religiosity and high satisfaction, and that it's really possible to take many areas of our life and integrate them and sort them through and make our individual decisions about. And I would say that many of these women are making their individual decisions. We are listening to many voices, and we are highly active at integrating those voices, and that we should be encouraged to do so. One of my most disheartening moments was talking to a stake president, who in fact was a psychiatrist, at one point, and he said something different in the pulpit than he said privately to me, and I said, there's a discrepancy between what you're saying over the pulpit and what I hear you say right now. And he said, I would rather have people come and puzzle with me in private than to do it openly. And my sense is that it should be the opposite, which is that we do puzzle in private. We do talk at all levels, and we should integrate that, and we should have an active encouragement to do so.
As an outsider, I would say that one thing the study showed is that free agency is alive and well.
Okay, way back here.
Yeah, you. As Dr. Christensen, I only got the first part, and I began laughing, and then the others around you continued. So, can you? Yeah, it sounded wonderful. Absolutely.
Well, look.
In terms of specific tips about increasing the I would say just two general things since we don't have much time. One of them is read. Go to any college bookstore, go to any large bookstore in any city, and look it over until it reaches you, because there are many, many books on sexuality from many sources. And so, I think Mormons are wonderful at taking secular material and transferring it to their own values. The only place we seem to have trouble with asking that question is in the area of sexuality. In other words, we read auto mechanics manuals, we read you know, scientific manuals, we read, I'm sure, the newspaper and People, and still transfer it back to our own values. So I think if you say, no, I'm going to read from every source and I will do my own translating, so to speak, then that will increase it, because, as one person said, the largest sex organ in the body is the brain. And so that will make a difference. The other is talking to your husband, and talking and talking and talking to other women and talking to whomever. Both of those approaches really make a difference, because sexuality, learning about our sexuality and asking and pepping it up, so to speak, isn't a matter of just sending more energy into it. It's a matter of knowing more and more about ourselves. And I think as we know more and more about ourselves, it becomes more exciting.
Just a quick perspective. I don't think it'll come very soon that we have this kind of presentation at General Conference. But there are changes. In my lifetime, I've seen less of the broadside general condemnation of unchastity, but no explanation to follow it up. And listeners are often baffled as to what it means in specific situations and what their personality is to respond to and so forth. And I don't think we'll find the answers to a lot of our personal problems in the Scriptures. And yet we're to read the Scriptures. And I don't think, personally, that we can expect to find specific answers to all of our personal problems, sexual as well as others, in prayer. And I believe in prayer. But the glory of God is intelligence. And Mormonism embraces that as well as the spiritual side. And intelligence means study and thought and learning. And even the church has a great university down the way here a little, and other schools, and has fostered education all along the line. Now, there are tugs and pulls as we move along, and some that are more conservative than others regarding these sensitive issues. But from my perspective, at least, and some of you wouldn't agree with this, we're making progress when we learn to face up to our problems and talk about them and understand them in sensible adult language, and in that way gain a better grip on our emotions and our choices and our behavior.
Thank you, Dr. Christensen.
I would like to say one more thing about improving your sex life. There's a wonderful book called American Couples by Bloomstein and Schwartz that is a study, a sociological study of 10,000 American couples. And one section is on sex. And they state that as the marriage generally has higher satisfaction and is more interesting, the sex is better.
May I remind you, I'm sorry we're out of time, but for those of you who, unlike that young lady, didn't take notes, you can get the tape of this session and still keep up with what's going on. I want to thank our panelists and all of you for attending this session. Please enjoy the rest of the symposium.
That wasn't too hard.
Oh, it was great. You were helpful.